red and green lights were going on and off everywhere. There were computer cabinets, consoles with lit-up video screens, and alphanumeric keyboards, and cables running all over the floor among unswept drifts of little bug-sized rectangles punched out of IBM cards, and a couple of Gestetner copy machines in the corner. And towering over the scene all along the walls, a number of Ampex tape reels busily twitching back and forth.
ARPANET, Fritz announced.
Ah, no, I'd better not. I've got to drive and stuff. Maybe just give me one for later.
It's a network of computers, Doc, all connected together by phone lines. UCLA, Isla Vista, Stanford. Say there's a file they have up there and you don't. They'll send it right along at 50,000 characters per second.
Wait, ARPA. That's the same outfit has their own sign up on the freeway at the Rosecrans exit?
Some connection with TRW. Nobody over there is too forthcoming. Like Ramo isn't telling Wooldridge.
But you're saying somebody hooked up to this thing might know where Shasta is?
Can't know till we look. All over the country, in fact the world, there's new computers getting plugged in every day. Right now it's still experimental, but hell, it's government money, and those fuckers don't care what they spend. And we've had some useful surprises already.
Does it know where I can score?
Chapter 5. Shasta had mentioned a possible Laughing Academy angle to Mickey Wolfman's matrimonial drama, and Doc thought it might be interesting to see how Society Page superstar Mrs. Sloan Wolfman would react when somebody brought up this topic. If Mickey was currently being held against his will in some private nuthouse, then Doc's immediate chore would be to try and find out which one. He called the number Shasta had given him, and the little woman herself picked up.
"I know it's awkward to be talking business right now, Mrs. Wolfman, but unfortunately time is a factor here."
"This wouldn't be another creditor inquiry, would it? There have been an astonishing number already. I'm referring them to our attorney. Do you have his number?"
Some kind of English smoker's voice, it seemed to Doc, at the low end of the register and unspecifiably decadent.
"Actually, it's our firm who owe your husband some money. As we're talking in the mid-six figures, we felt we should bring it to your attention." He waited half a sub-vocalized bar of The Great Pretender.
"Mrs. Wolfman?"
"I may have a few minutes free around noon," she said. "Whom did you say you represented?"
"Modern Institute for Cognitive Repatterning and Overhaul," Doc said. "Micro, for short. We're a private clinic out near Hacienda Heights, specializing in the repair of stressed personalities."
"Ordinarily, I review all of Michael's larger disbursements, and I must confess, Mr. Is it Sportello, that I am unfamiliar with any dealings he may have had with you."
Doc's nose had begun to run, a sure sign that he was onto something here. "Perhaps given the sum in question, it might be easier after all to work through your attorney."
It took her a tenth of a second to calculate how much of a shark bite out of the surfboard that might involve. "Not at all, Mr. Sportello. Perhaps it's only your voice, but you may consider me officially intrigued."
In a former ensuite broom closet at the office, Doc had assembled a collection of disguises. He decided today on a double-breasted velour suit from Zeidler & Zeidler, and found a short-haired wig that almost matched the suit. He considered a glue-on mustache, but figured simpler would be better. Switched his sandals for standard-issue loafers, and put on a tie narrower and less colorful than currently fashionable, hoping Mrs. Wolfman would read this as pathetically unhip. Looking in the mirror, he almost recognized himself. Groovy. He considered lighting a joint, but resisted the impulse.
At the print shop down the street, his friend Jake, used to rush orders, ran him off a couple 3 business cards with the legend, Micro. Reconfiguring Southland Brains since 1966. Larry Sportello, licensed associate. Which was true enough, long as you meant a California driver's license. On the Coast Highway, about halfway to the Wolfman residence, the Bonzo Dog Band, cover of Bang Bang, came on from KRLA in Pasadena, and Doc cranked up the vibrasonic. As he moved up into the hills, the reception began to fade, so he drove slower, but eventually lost the signal. Before long, he found himself on a sunny street somewhere in the Santa Monica Mountains, parked near a house with high stucco walls, over which flowers of some exotic creeper poured in a flame-colored cascade. Doc thought he spotted somebody looking down at him from one of the openings of a mission-style loggia running the length of the top floor. Heat of some kind, a sniper no doubt, though federal or local, who knew? A presentable young Chicana in jeans and an old SC sweatshirt answered the door and checked him out with dramatically made-up eyes. "She's hanging by the pool, with all the police in them. Come on upstairs." It was a reverse floor plan, with bedrooms on the entrance level and then upstairs the kitchen, maybe more than one, and various entertainment areas. The house should have been full of law enforcement. Instead, the boys from Protect and Serve had set up a command post at the pool cabana somewhere out and back, like getting in some last-minute free catering before their federal overlord showed up. Sounds of distant splashing, rock and roll radio, eating between meals, some kidnapping. As if auditioning for widowhood, Sloan Wolfman strolled in from poolside wearing black spiked heeled sandals, a headband with a sheer black veil, and a black bikini of negligible size made of the same material as the veil. She wasn't exactly an English rose, maybe more like an English daffodil. Very pale, blonde, reedy, probably bruised easily. Overdid her eye makeup like everybody else. Miniskirts were invented for young women like her. In the time it took her to lead him through a dim, sunken interior full of taupe carpeting, suede upholstery, and teak, which seemed to extend indefinitely in the direction of Pasadena, Doc learned that she had a degree from the London School of Economics, had recently begun studying tantric yoga, and had met Mickey Wolfman originally in Las Vegas. She waved at a picture on the wall, which looked like a blow-up of an 8x10 glossy from the lobby area of some nightclub. "Why, goodness," said Doc. "It's you, isn't it?" Sloan made with the half-frown, half-smirk Doc had noticed among minor and ex-showbiz people trying to be modest. "My lurid youth. I was one of those notorious Vegas showgirls working at one of the casinos. Up on stage in those days, with the lights, the eyelashes, all the makeup, we did look fairly much alike. But Michael, something of a connoisseur in these matters, as I was later to learn, said that he picked me out the minute I walked on. And after that, I was really the only one he could see. Romantic, isn't it? Yes. Certainly unexpected. Next thing either of us knew, we were down at the little Church of the West, and I had this on my finger." Flashing a gigantic marquise-cut diamond up in the double digit someplace with respect to carats. She had told the story hundreds of times, but that was all right. "Handsome stone," Doc said. Like an actress hitting her mark, she had come to a pause beneath a looming portrait of Mickey Wolfman, shown with a distant stare, as if scanning the L.A. basin to its farthest horizons for buildable lots. She whirled to face Doc and smiled sociably. "Here we are, then." Doc noticed a sort of fake chiseled stone frieze above the portrait, which read, "Once you get that first stake driven, Nobody Can Stop You, Robert Moses.
A great American, and Michael's inspiration, said Sloan. That's always been his motto.
I thought Dr. Van Helsing said that.
She'd found and stopped exactly inside a flattering convergence of lights that made her look like some contract star of the grand studio era, about to let loose with an emotional speech at some less expensive actor. Doc tried not to glance around too obviously to see where the light was coming from, but she noticed the flicker off his eyeballs.
Do you like the lighting? Jimmy Wong Howe did it for us years ago.
The DP on Body and Soul, wasn't he? Not to mention They Made Me a Criminal, Dust Be My Destiny, Saturday's Children.
Those, quizzically, are all John Garfield movies.
Well, yes.
Jimmy did film other actors.
I'm sure he did. Oh, and Out of the Fog, too, where John Garfield is this evil gangster.
Actually, what I find memorable about that picture is the way Jimmy lit Ida Lupino, which, now I think of it, had a lot to do with selling me on this house. Jimmy was certainly fond enough of specular highlights, all that prizefighter sweat and chrome and jewelry and sequins and so forth. But his work also had such a spiritual quality. You look at Ida Lupino in her close-ups, those eyes, and instead of hard-edged lamp reflections, there's this glow, this purity, almost as if it's coming from inside. Excuse me, is that what I think it is?
Darn, it's that Ida Lupino. Every time her name comes up, so does this. Please don't take it personally.
How curious. I can't recall ever feeling that way about John Garfield. But as I have a meditation appointment at 1, we might find time for drinks if we guzzle them down fast enough, and perhaps you can even tell me what you're doing here.
Luz!
The young lady who let him in appeared from the artfully sculpted shadows.
Señora? The midday refrescos now, if you wouldn't mind, Luz. I do hope, Mr. Sportello, that margaritas will be satisfactory, though given your film preferences, perhaps some sort of beer and whiskey arrangement would be more appropriate.
Thank you, Mrs. Wolfman. Tequila's just fine. And what a welcome relief not to be offered any pot. I'll never understand what these hippies see in this stuff. Do you mind if I smoke a normal cigarette, by the way?
She nodded graciously, and Doc fished out a pack of Benson and Hedges menthol he'd remembered to bring instead of Cools, given the expected class level here and so forth, and offered her one, and they both lit up. Sounds reached them from a pool whose dimensions he could only imagine of policemen at play.
I'll try to keep this brief and you can return to your guests. Your husband was planning to endow a new wing for us, as part of our expansion program, and shortly before his puzzling disappearance, he actually had tendered us a sum in advance. But somehow it just didn't seem right to keep the money while so little is known of his whereabouts. So we'd like to refund you the sum, preferably before the end of the quarter. And if, and as we all pray, when Mr. Wolfman is next heard from, why then, perhaps the process can resume.
She was squinting, however, and shaking her head a little. I'm not sure. We recently endowed another facility in Ojai, I believe. Are you somehow a subsidiary, or...
Perhaps it's one of our sister's sanatoria. There's been a program for some years.
She had stepped over to a small antique desk in the corner, bent so as to present to Doc's gaze an unquestionably alluring ass, and took some time rummaging through different pigeonholes before coming up with another publicity shot of herself. This was a photo of a groundbreaking ceremony, with Sloan sitting at the controls of a front-end loader and backhoe rig,
in whose bucket could be seen one of those oversized checks that also get handed to winners of bowling tournaments. A personage in a doctor outfit was smiling and pretending to look at the amount, which ran to a lot of zeros, but he was really gazing up Sloane's skirt, which was fashionably short. She was also wearing shades, almost as if she didn't want to be recognized, and an expression conveying how much she didn't want to be there. A banner behind her carried a date and the name of the institution, though both were just out of focus enough that Doc couldn't get much more than an impression of a long, foreign-looking word. He was wondering how suspicious it would make Sloane if he asked the name, when Luz came back in with a tray holding a gigantic pitcher full of margaritas and some chilled glasses of an exotic shape whose only purpose was to make it impossible for the servants to wash them without the help of some high-ticket custom dish mop.
"Thank you, Luz. Shall I be mother?"
Taking the pitcher and pouring. Doc noticed there was an extra glass on the tray. So it wasn't too much of a surprise when presently he saw reflected in the screen of a mammoth TV in the corner a large, muscular blonde person coming silently down the stairs and moving toward them across the carpeting like an assassin in a kung fu movie. Doc got up to have a look and say howdy, quickly noting that any prolonged eye contact here would mean a visit to the chiropractor for neck work, this party having 3 feet of altitude on him easy.
"This is Mr. Riggs Warbling," said Sloane, "my spiritual coach."
Doc didn't see them actually, exchanging glances, as Frank might put it. But if acid tripping was good for anything, it helped tune you to different unlisted frequencies. No doubt these two had actually sat now and then on adjoining meditation mats, pretending to empty their heads just for anybody that might be nearby. Luz, the heat, himself. But Doc would bet an ounce of seedless Hawaiian and throw in a pack of zigzags that Sloane and old Riggs here were also fucking regularly, and that this was the BF Shasta had mentioned. Sloane poured Riggs a drink and angled the pitcher inquiringly in Doc's direction.
"Thanks. Gotta be back in the office. Maybe you can tell us where to send this refund and what form you'd like it in."
"Small bills," boomed Riggs amiably, "with non-consecutive serial numbers."
"Riggs, Riggs."
Sloane not as grimly as might be expected, given the possibility still open that her husband had been kidnapped.
"Always making with the tasteless jokes. Perhaps if one of your company officers simply endorsed Michael's check back to one of his bank accounts."
"Of course. Let us know the account number and it's as good as in the mail."
"I'll just go pop in the office for a moment then."
Riggs Warbling had appropriated the margarita jug, which he was taking sips from without going through the exercise of pouring anything into a glass. With no warning, he blurted,
"I'm into zomes."
"Beg pardon?"
"I'm a contractor. I design and build zomes. That's short for zonahedral domes. Greatest advance in structure since Bucky Fuller. Here, let me show you."
He had brought out from somewhere a pad of quadrille paper and begun sketching on it, using numbers and symbols which might have been Greek, and pretty soon he was going on about vector spaces and symmetry groups. Doc grew convinced of unwelcome developments inside his brain, though the diagrams were kind of hip-looking.
"Zomes make great meditation spaces," Riggs went on. "Do you know, some people have actually walked into zomes and not come back out the same way they went in, and sometimes not at all. Like, zomes are portals to someplace else, especially if they're located out in the desert, which is where I've been for most of last year."
"Uh-huh. You've been working for Mickey Wolfman?"
"At Arrepentimiento."
That's a long-time dream project of his, near Las Vegas. Maybe you saw the piece on it in Architectural Digest.
Missed it. Actually, the only magazine Doc read with any regularity was Naked Teen Nymphos, which he subscribed to, or at least used to, till he began to find the few copies that had made it to his mailbox opened already, and with pages stuck together. But he decided not to mention this. Sloan came sashaying back over, holding a slip of paper.
The only number I can find at the moment is for a joint account at one of Michael's S&Ls. I hope that won't present a problem for your people. Here's a blank deposit form, if that's any help.
Doc stood and Sloan stayed where she was, which was close enough for her to be seized and violated, a thought which unavoidably crossed Doc's mind, taking its time, in fact, and more than once looking back and winking. Who knows what lurid acts might have followed had Luz not reappeared and flashed him, unless he was hallucinating from tequila, a warning look.
Luz, could you please see Mr. Sportello out?
Downstairs, among corridors leading off to some unknown number of bedroom suites, Doc, as if just remembering he had to piss, said, "Mind if I use a bathroom?"
"Sure, long as you don't steal anything."
Oh, dear. I hope that doesn't mean any of those policemen out by the pool have been reverting to type. That is to say,
she wagged a finger no, and glancing quickly around as if the house might be bugged, crooked her arm and flexed a bicep while rolling her eyes upstairs.
Riggs, it figured.
Doc smiled and nodded, and for the benefit of any audience said,
"Thank you, muchas gracias there, Lutz. I won't be but a minute."
She slouched gracefully against the doorway and watched him, her eyes dark and busy. Doc located the door to a palatial bathroom and, guessing it was Mickey's, went in, and then on into the adjoining bedroom. Snooping around, he came across a number of strange neckties hanging inside a walk-in closet on a rack of their own. He switched on a light and had a look. At first glance, they seemed to be vintage, hand-painted silk ties, each with an image of a different nude young woman on it. But these were not exactly vintage nudes. Erect clits, spread pussy lips with sort of highlights on them to suggest wetness, over-the-shoulder invitations to anal entry, each goosebump and pubic hair painstakingly set down in photographic detail. Doc became lost in art appreciation, having noticed something striking about the faces as well. They weren't just cartoon features taking on some catalog of fuck-me expressions. These seemed to be the faces, and he guessed the bodies, of specific women. Maybe some kind of a Mickey Wolfman girlfriend inventory. Was Shasta Faye in here by any chance? Doc began to flip through the ties one by one, trying not to sweat on anything. He had just come across Sloane's image, inaugurably Sloan and not just some blonde, lying back among tangled sheets, arms and legs open, eyelids lowered, lips shining. An almost gentlemanly angle to Mickey's character he hadn't counted on, when a hand slid around his waist from behind.
"Yeah!"
"Keep looking. I'm in there someplace," Luz said.
"I'm ticklish, babe."
"There I am. Cute, huh?"
Sure enough, it was Luz in full color, on her knees, gazing upward with her teeth bared in what wasn't, it seemed to Doc, especially inviting smile.
"My tits aren't really that big, but it's the thought that counts."
"Did you ladies all pose for these?"
"Yep. Guy over in North Hollywood does custom work."
"How about that chick, what's her name?"
Doc trying to keep a tremor out of his voice.
"The one that's been missing."
"Oh, Shasta. Yeah, she's in there someplace."
But as it turned out strangely, she wasn't.
Doc looked at the couple three ties remaining, but none of them had Shasta's picture on it. Luz was gazing over his shoulder into Mickey's bedroom. "He always used to take me in the shower to fuck," she reminisced. "I never got a chance to do anything on that groovy bed in there."
"Seems easy enough to arrange," Doc said smoothly. "Maybe..." At which point, wouldn't you know, came a horrible low-fidelity screech from an intercom speaker out in the hall.
"Luz! ¿Dónde estás, mi hijita?"
"Shit," murmured Luz.
"Another time, perhaps." At the door, Doc gave her one of the fake microcards, which had his real office number on it. She slipped it in the back pocket of her jeans.
"You're not really a shrink, are you?"
Maybe not, but I do have a couch."
"Psicodélico ese,"
flashing those famous teeth. Doc was just getting in his car when a black and white came barreling around the corner with all its lights going, and pulled up next to him. A window on the shotgun side came cranking down, and Bigfoot leaned out.
"Wrong part of town for scoring weed, isn't it, Sportello?"
"What? You mean my mind's been wandering again?"
The cop driving killed the motor, and they both got out and approached Doc. Unless Bigfoot had been demoted in some strange piece of LAPD disrespect Doc knew he'd never begin to understand, this other cop could in no way have been Bigfoot's partner, though he might be a close relative. They both had the same smooth and evil look. This party now raised his eyebrows at Doc.
"Mind if we have a look through that attractive purse, sir?"
"Nothing but my lunch," Doc assured him.
"Oh, we'll see you get your lunch." "Now, now, Sportello's only doing his job," Bigfoot pretended to soothe the other cop. "Trying to figure out what happened to Mickey Wolfman, just like the rest of us. Anything so far you'd like to share on that, Sportello? Who's, beg pardon, how's the missus doing?"
"That's one brave little lady," Doc nodding sincerely. He thought about getting into what Pat Dubonnet had told him about Bigfoot and Mickey being ace buddies, but there was something about the way this other cop was listening to them. Way too attentive. Maybe even, if you wanted to be paranoid about it, as if he was undercover, reporting to some other level inside the LAPD. His real job, basically, to keep an eye on Bigfoot. Too much to think about. Doc deployed his most feckless doper's grin. "There's law enforcement in there, guys, but nobody introduced me. Could even be the Federales, for all I know."
"I love it when a case goes all to hell," remarked Bigfoot with a sunny smile. "Don't you, Lester? Doesn't it just remind you why we're all here?" "Cheer up, compadre," said Lester, returning to the car. "Our day will come."
Off they sped, hitting the siren just to be cute. Doc got in his car and sat staring at the Wolfman residence. Something had been puzzling him now for a while. Namely, what exactly was with Bigfoot here, riding around in these black and whites all the time? Far as Doc knew, detectives in suits and ties rode in unmarked sedans, usually two at a time, and uniformed officers did the same. But he couldn't recall ever seeing Bigfoot on the job with another detective. Oh, wait a minute. Out of the permanent smog alert he liked to think of as his memory, something began to emerge. A rumor, likely by way of Pat Dubonnet, about a partner of Bigfoot's who'd been shot and killed a while back in the line of duty. And ever since then, so the story went, Bigfoot had worked alone. No replacements either asked for or assigned. If this meant Bigfoot was still in some kind of cop mourning, he and the dead guy must have been unusually close. This bond between partners was nearly the only thing Doc had ever found to admire about the LAPD.
For all the department's long, sorrowful history of corruption and abuse of power, here was at least something they had not sold but kept for themselves, forged in the dangerous life-and-death uncertainties of one working day after another. Something real that had to be respected. No faking it. No question of buying it with favors, money, promotions. The entire range of capitalist inducement couldn't get you 5 seconds of attention to your back when it really counted. You had to go out there and earn it by putting your pitiful ass on the line again and again. Without knowing any details of the history Bigfoot and his late partner had been through together, Doc would still bet the contents of his stash for the next year that Bigfoot, if improbably asked to generate a list of people he loved, would have put this guy up near the top. Meaning what, however? Was Doc about to start offering Bigfoot free advice? No, no, no. Bad idea, Doc warned himself. Bad idea. Just let the man deal with his grief or whatever it is without your help, okay? Sure, Doc answered himself. Cool with me, man. Chapter 6. Unable to reach her at home, Doc finally had to call Deputy DA Penny Kimball at her office downtown. A lunch date had just happened to cancel, so she agreed to pencil Doc in. He showed up at a peculiar Skid Row eatery off Temple, where wine abusers up from bedrolls and vacant lots, back of what remained of the old nickel, mingled with Superior Court judges taking recess breaks, not to mention a population of lawyers in suits, whose high decibel jabbering rebounded off the mirrored walls, rattling and threatening at times to knock over all the 85-cent Mickeys of Muscatel and Tokay stacked up in pyramids behind the steam tables. Presently, in strolled Penny, one hand loosely in a jacket pocket, exchanging civilized remarks with any number of perfectly groomed co-workers. She was wearing shades and one of those gray polyester business outfits with a very short skirt. "This Wolfman Sherlock case," is how she greeted Doc. "Apparently one of your old girlfriends is a principal." Not that he was expecting a friendly kiss or anything. There were colleagues watching, and he didn't want to, what you'd call, fuck up her act. She put her attaché case on the table and sat staring at Doc. A courtroom technique, no doubt. "I just heard that she skipped," Doc said. "Put it another way. How close were you and Shasta Faye Hepworth?" He'd been asking himself this for a while now, but didn't know the answer. "It was all over with years ago," he said. "Months?" "She had other fish to fry." "Did it break my heart?" "Sure did. If you hadn't come along, babe, who knows how bad it might have got?" "True. You were a fucking mess. But old times aside, have you had any contact with Miss Hepworth in, say, the last week or so?" "Well, now, funny you should ask. She called me up a couple days before Mickey Wolfman disappeared, with a story about how his wife and her boyfriend were plotting to hustle Mickey into the booby hatch and grab all his money. So I sure hope you guys or the cops or whoever are looking into that." "And with your years of experience as a PI, would you call that a reliable lead?"
"I've known worse." "Oh, wait, I dig. You're all going to just ignore this, right? Some hippie chick with boyfriend trouble, brains all discombobulated with dope, sex, rock and roll."
"Doc, I never see you this emotional."
"'Cause the lights are out, usually."
"Uh-huh. Well, apparently you didn't tell any of this to Lieutenant Bjornson when he pulled you in at the crime scene."
"I promised Shasta I'd come talk to you first. See if anybody at the DA's shop could help. Kept calling you day and night, no reply. Next thing I know, Wolfman's gone. Glenn Sherlock's dead."
"And Bjornson seems to think you're as good a suspect as anyone in this."
seems to. You've been talking to Bigfoot about me?
Wow. Well, never trust a flatland chick, man. Prime directive of life at the beach. Oh, we've been to each other, too. Hey, if that's the way it must be, okay, as Roy Orbison always says, holding out his wrist dramatically. Let's get it over with.
Doc, shh, please.
She was so cute when she got embarrassed, nose wrinkling and so forth, but it didn't last long.
Besides, maybe you did do it. Has that crossed your mind yet? Maybe you just conveniently forgot about it the way you do so often forget things, and this peculiar reaction of yours now is a typically twisted way of confessing the act.
Well, but how would I forget something like that?
Grass, and who knows what else, Doc?
Hey, come on, I'm only a light smoker.
Oh? How many joints a day on average?
Have to look in the log.
Listen, Bjornsson's in charge of the case, that's all. He'll be interviewing hundreds of you people.
Us people. Come in my fucking window again's basically what you're saying.
According to police reports, you have tended to barricade your door on previous occasions.
You pull my jacket and look me up? Penny, you really do care.
With a glance meant to be appreciative, but which all these mirrors in here, as Doc checked out his image, were somehow presenting as just another red-eyed doper's stare. I'm going after a sandwich. Can I bring you something? Ham, lamb, or beef?
Maybe just vegetable of the day.
Doc watched her getting in line. What kind of DDA game was she running on him now? He wished he could believe her more, but the business was unforgiving, and life in psychedelic 60s L.A. offered more cautionary arguments than you could wave a joint at against too much trust, and the 70s were looking no more promising. Penny knew more about this case than she was telling Doc. He'd seen enough of that shifty way legals had of holding back information. Lawyers taught it to each other, attended weekend seminars out in motels in La Puente, just to work on greasiness skills. And there was no reason, sad to say, that Penny should be any exception. She got back to the table with the vegetable of the day, steamed Brussels sprouts heaped on a plate. Doc waded in.
Yum, man. See that Tabasco a minute?
Hey, have you talked to anybody over at the coroner's? Maybe your friend Lagonda's seen Glenn's autopsy. Penny shrugged. Lagonda describes the matter as very sensitive there. The body's already been cremated, and she won't say any more than that. She watched Doc eat for a while. Well, and how's everything at the beach? With a low sincerity smile, he knew enough by now to beware. Groovy? Psychedelic? Surf bunnies all as attentive as ever? Oh, and how are those two stews I caught you with that time?
I told you, man, it was that jacuzzi. The pumps were on too high. Those bikinis just kind of mysteriously came undone. It wasn't nothing deliberate.
As it seems she never missed a chance to do lately, Penny was referring to Doc's off-and-on partners in mischief, the notorious Stewardii Lourdes and Motella, who occupied a palatial bachelorette pad in Gordita, down on Beachfront Drive, with a sauna and a pool, and a bar in the middle of the pool, and usually an endless supply of high-quality weed, as the ladies were known to smuggle in forbidden merchandise, having by now, it was said, enormous fortunes stashed in offshore bank accounts. Yet after nightfall, most any layover here, it seemed that they ended up cruising the bleak arterials of dismal L.A. backwaters, seeking out of some helpless fatality the company of lowlives of opportunity.
Maybe you'll be seeing them sometime soon?
Penny avoiding eye contact. Lourdes and Motella, he inquired as gently as he could. They're, chicks of interest to your shop?
Not so much them as some company they've been keeping lately. If in the course of bikini-related activities you should happen to hear them mention by name either or both of a pair of young gentlemen known as Cookie and Joaquin, could you try to make note of it on something waterproof and let me know?
Hey, if you're thinking of dating outside the legal profession, I can sure fix you up. If you're really desperate, there's always me.
She'd been looking at her watch. Hectic week ahead for me, Doc, so unless any of this heats up dramatically, I hope you understand.
As romantically as he could, Doc sang her a few quiet falsetto bars of Wouldn't It Be Nice. She had learned the technique of pointing her face one way and her eyes another, in this case sideways at Doc, with her lids half shut, and a smile she knew would have its effect.
Walk me back to the office?
Outside the Hall of Justice, as if remembering something.
Do you mind if I just drop something off next door at the federal courthouse? It won't take a minute.
They weren't two steps into the lobby before being joined, or did he mean surrounded, by a couple of feds in cheap suits who could have used a little more time in the sun.
These are my next-door neighbors, Special Agent Flatweed, Special Agent Borderline, Doc Sportello.
Gotta say, I've always admired you guys. 8 p.m. every Sunday night. Wow, I never miss an episode.
The ladies' room is down this way, right? Said Penny. I'll be back in a jiffy.
Doc watched her out of sight. He knew her gait when she had to piss, and this wasn't it. She wouldn't be back anytime soon. He had about a second and a half to get spiritually prepared before Agent Flatweed said,
Come on, Larry, let's find us a cup of joe.
They politely but firmly steered him into an elevator, and for a minute he wondered when he'd get to smoke a joint again. Upstairs they waved Doc into a cubicle with framed pictures of Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover. The coffee, in sumptuous black cups with gold FBI insignia, didn't taste like it accounted for too much of their entertainment budget. From what Doc could make out, both Federals seemed newly arrived in town, maybe even straight from our nation's capital. By now he had seen a few of these back east envoys who landed in California expecting to have to deal with rebellious and exotic natives, and either maintained a force field of contempt till the tour of duty was up, or else with blinding speed found themselves barefoot and stoned, putting their stick in their woody and following the surf off wherever it might roll. There seemed no middle range of choices. It was hard for Doc not to imagine these two as surf Nazis, doomed to repeat a film loop of some violent but entertaining beach movie wipeout. Agent Borderline had taken out a folder and begun to look through it.
Hey, what's that you got there?
Doc angling his head amiably, Ronald Reagan style, to peer at it.
A federal file? On me? Wow, man, a big time.
Agent Borderline closed the folder abruptly and slid it into a pile of others on a credenza. But not before Doc saw a blurred telephoto shot of himself out in a parking lot, probably Tommy's, sitting on the hood of his car holding a gigantic cheeseburger and peering into it quizzically, actually poking through the layers of pickles, oversized tomato slices, lettuce, chili, onions, cheese, and so forth, not to mention the ground beef part of it, which was almost an afterthought. An obvious giveaway to those who knew about Krishna the fry cook's practice of including somewhere in this, for 50 cents extra, a joint wrapped in waxed paper. Actually, the tradition had begun in Compton years ago, and found its way to Tommy's at least by the summer of 68, when Doc, in the famished aftermath of a demonstration against NBC's plans to cancel Star Trek, had joined a convoy of irate fans in pointed rubber ears and Starfleet uniforms to plunge, it seemed, down Beverly Boulevard into deep L.A.,
around a dog leg, and on into a patch of town tucked in between the Hollywood and Harbor freeways, which is where he first beheld, at the corner of Beverly and Coronado, the burger navel of the universe.
"What's that?" I was lost in thought.
"You were drilling on the desk, and you weren't supposed to see that file."
"Only wondering if you had any copies. I always like to carry some pictures around in case people want autographs."
"These days, as you may know," Agent Flatweed said, "most of the energy in this office is going into investigating black nationalist hate groups, and it's come to our attention that you had a visit yourself not long ago from a known black prison militant calling himself Tariq Khalil. We naturally became curious."
"It's the chronology, really," Agent Borderline pretended to explain. "Khalil visits your place of business next day. A known prison acquaintance of his is slain. Michael Wolfman disappears, and you get arrested on suspicion."
"And cut loose again. Don't forget that part. Have you guys talked to Bigfoot Bjornsson about this? He has the whole file on the case, way more information than I ever will, and you'd really like talking to him. He's real intelligent and shit."
"Lieutenant Bjornsson's impatience with the federal level is widely remarked on," Agent Borderline, looking up from speed-reading another folder. "And his cooperation, if any, is likely to be limited. You, on the other hand, may know things he doesn't. For example, what about these two employees of Kahuna Airlines, Miss Motella Haywood and Miss Lourdes Rodriguez?"
Whom Penny had also just been asking about. What a strange and weird coincidence.
"Well, what have these young ladies got to do with your black nationalist COINTELPRO, not, I hope, just 'cause they both happen to be of non-Anglo origins or nothing?"
"Ordinarily," said Agent Flatweed, "we're the ones who ask the questions."
"Sure thing, fellas, except aren't we all in the same business?"
"There's no need to be insulting. Why don't you just share with us what Mr. Khalil had to say the other day when he visited you?"
suggested Agent Borderline.
"Oh, because he's a client, so that's privileged conversation, is why not? Sorry."
"If it has bearing on the Wolfman case, we might have to disagree."
"Groovy. But what I can't figure is if your shop is really so focused on the Black Panthers and all that, lets you and him fight with Ron Karenga's folks and so forth, what's with this FBI interest in Mickey Wolfman? Somebody's been playing Monopoly with federal housing money? No, couldn't be that, 'cause this is L.A. There's no such thing here. What else, then, I wonder?"
"We can't comment."
Agent Flatweed, smug, and Doc hoped, lulled by his deliberately clueless cross-inquiry.
"Oh, wait, I know. After 24 hours, it's officially a kidnap case. State lines or whatever, so you guys must be figuring it for a Panther operation. Say they put the snatch on Mickey to make some political point, and get a shot at some nice ransom money, too, while they're at it."
At which the two Federals, as if unable not to, had a quick, nervous look at each other, suggesting they'd at least thought about this for a cover story.
"Well, bummer and so forth, wish I could help, but that Khalil guy didn't even leave me a phone number. You know how irresponsible they can get."
Doc stood, put out his cigarette and the rest of his FBI coffee. "Tell Penny how groovy it was of her to set up this little get-together. Oh, and hey, can I be frank for a minute?"
"Of course," said Agents Flatweed and Borderline.
Snapping his fingers, Doc sang himself out the door with four bars of Fly Me to the Moon, more or less on pitch, and added, "I know that the director has a thing about spade penises, and I sure hope you find Mickey before any of that cell block stuff starts happening."
"He's not cooperating," Agent Borderline muttered.
"Keep in touch, Larry," called Agent Flatweed. "Remember, as a COINTELPRO informant, you could be making up to $300 a month."
"Sure. Say hi to Lou Erskine and the gang."
All the way down in the elevator, though, it was Penny that Doc was worrying about. If the best bargaining chip she had these days was to shop him to the Federales, she had to be in some deep shit with somebody. But how deep? And who with? The only connection he saw right offhand was that both Federal and County Heat shared a common interest in the Stewardii Lourdes and Motella and their friends Cookie and Joaquin. Yep, he had best go look into that as soon as possible, not least because the girls were just back from Hawaii and probably had some heavy-duty dope in the house. Meantime, people were seeing Mickey all over the place, in the meat section at Ralph's in Culver City, shoplifting filet mignons in party-sized lots, out at Santa Anita in earnest discussion with a person named either Shorty or Speedy, in some accounts, both, in a bar in Los Mochis, watching an old episode of The Invaders dubbed into Spanish and writing urgent memos to himself, in airport VIP lounges from Heathrow to Honolulu, drinking heedless combinations of grape and grain not seen since the days of Prohibition, at anti-war rallies in the Bay Area, begging a variety of armed authorities to mow him down and end his troubles, out at Joshua Tree doing peyote, ascending into the sky, haloed in an all but unwatchable radiance towards spacecraft not of earthly origin, so forth. Doc started a file on all these reports, and hoped he wouldn't forget where he was stashing it. Coming out of work later in the day, he happened to notice in the parking lot this tall, lanky blonde, plus an equally familiar Oriental cutie. Yes, it was those two young ladies from the Chick Planet massage parlor. "Hey, Jade! Bambi!" The girls, casting paranoid glances back over attractive bare shoulders, ran and jumped into a species of Harley Earl Impala, screeched out of the lot and smoked away down West Imperial. Trying not to take this personally, Doc went back inside, looking for Petunia, who, shaking her head reproachfully, handed him a flyer for the Chick Planet Massage Pussy Eater Special. "Oh, well, I can explain this." "Dark and lonely work," muttered Petunia. "But somebody has to do it. Something like that. Oh, Doc." On the back of the flyer, written with an applicator and hot pink toenail polish, it said, "Heard they cut you loose. Need to see you about something. I'm working weeknights at Club Asiatique in San Pedro. Love and peace, Jade. P.S. Beware of the Golden Fang." Well, actually, Doc wouldn't have minded a brief word or two with that Jade either, seeing how, being the last person he'd spoken with back at Chick Planet before he'd slipped, as Jim Morrison might put it, into unconsciousness, she could have had a role in setting his unwary ass up for whoever had snatched Mickey Wolfman and shot down Glenn Sharlock. So, knowing them to be longtime Club Asiatique regulars, he headed directly for the beachfront mansion of Lourdes and Motella, who, it turned out this evening, were headed down to that very waterfront dive to meet their current heartthrobs, FBI persons of interest Cookie and Joaquin, offering Doc a chance to find out why the Federales should be so interested, while at the same time wrecking any hopes he might have entertained for some drug-enhanced three-way among just him and the girls. Now, as Fats Domino always says, never to be, which was how it usually worked out anyway with these two. "Okay if I tag along?" Motella gave him a skeptical once-over. "Those huaraches are marginal. The bell-bottoms will do, but the top needs some work. Here, have a look." Leading him to a closet full of gear, from whose dimness Doc grabbed the first Hawaiian shirt he could see, parrots and psychedelic color schemes, some visible only under black light, that would have gotten them second looks even from parrot communities already noted for their extravagance of feather shades, plus hibiscus blossoms that merely snorting them would send you off onto nasal acid trips in tubular green phosphorescent surf. A very yellow crescent moon. Hula girls with big tits.
You can also wear these.
Handing him a string of love beads from the Kahuna Airlines duty-free head shop, which opened whenever the airplane entered international airspace.
But I'll want them back.
Ah!
Lourdes, meantime in the bathroom, screaming with her nose to the mirror,
"Photo courtesy of NASA!"
"It's this light in here," Doc hastened to point out. "You look fine, you guys, fine, really." They did, and soon, togged out in matching dresses from the Dynasty Salon at the Hong Kong Hilton, the girls, one on each of Doc's arms, proceeded down to the alley, where, locked in a garage with a single dusty window, through the bleared old glass, there glowed this dream of a supernaturally cherry vintage auburn, maroon in color with some walnut trim, and bearing the license plate LNM Wow. Driving down the San Diego and Harbor freeways, the high-spirited stewardy-eye filled Doc in on a list of Cookie and Joaquin virtues he would ordinarily have zoned out in the middle of. But since the FBI's curiosity about the boys had provoked his own, he felt obliged to listen. It was also a distraction from what seemed to Doc the unnecessarily suicidal way Lourdes was piloting the Auburn. On the radio was a golden oldie by the Boards, in which rock critics had noticed a certain Beach Boys influence.
"Thought I must have been hallucinating, waiting at the light you called to me, let's go. How am I supposed to refuse an 18-year-old cutie in a GTO? We took off north from the light at Topanga, tire smoking in a long hot scream. Under the hood of my Ford Mustang, a 427 camera running just like a dream. Grill to grill by the time we hit Leo Carrillo. And it still wasn't over by Point Magoo. Just a Ford Mustang and a sweet GTO. In a motion by the ocean doing what the motorheads do. Should have filled up when I got off of San Diego. It's been pinned on empty for the last 10 miles. Next thing I know, she's waving hasta luego, flashing one of those big California smiles."
Doc tried to listen to the instrumental break, and though the horn section put some nice mariachi harmonies onto Leo Carrillo, the tenor player didn't seem to be Coy Harlingen, just another specialist in one or two note solos.
"Bummed out on the shoulder, couldn't feel bluer. Here comes that familiar Ram Air Blast. What's that on the front seat right next to her? It's a shiny red can full of high-test gas. So we groove back on down past Leo Carrillo. Grill to grill all the way down to Malibu. Just a Ford Mustang and that sweet GTO in motion by the ocean. Doing what the motorheads do."
The girls in the front seat were bouncing up and down, squealing, "A toda madre," and "What it be, girl," and so forth.
"Cookie and Joaquin, they are so bitchin'," swooned Motella.
"Seguro ese."
"Well, actually, I meant Cookie is. I can't really speak for Joaquin, can I?"
"How's that, Motella?"
"Ooh, like wondering how it must be getting into bed with somebody who has another person's name tattooed on his body."
"No problem unless all you do in bed is read," muttered Lourdes.
"Ladies, ladies," Doc pretended to push them apart like Mo going, "Spread out." Doc gathered that Cookie and Joaquin were a couple of ex-grunts newly out of Vietnam, back in the world at last, though it seemed still pursuing missions of consequence, having caught wind just before they left of some
demented scheme featuring connexes full of U.S. currency being transshipped, it was believed, to Hong Kong. In-country traffic in dollars ordinarily fetched many long years in the stockade, but with the money now physically in international waters, according to various bullshit artists of their acquaintance, the situation was bound to be different. They had manifested on